So I'm here to talk to you today about the problem of interoperability checking and the tool that we've implemented to significantly automate checking real-world product implementations. This is joint work with Ramesh from USC, Ari and Todd from UCLA, and Nupur and Ratul from Microsoft. So before I get started, let me first define what I mean by interoperability. So let's say two systems, say Internet Explorer and the Apache web server, are trying to communicate. And these two implementations are designed to talk to each other, and they have both agreed upon HTTP 1.1 as defined in RFC 2616. Now, the problem arises when these implementations interpret the standard in a different way, and communication breaks down as a consequence. And yet, protocol interoperability is absolutely crucial for the reliability and correct operation of modern-day network systems. And yet, we've had some public embarrassments regarding this, and this has made its way into the trade press. A good example is SIP, the Session Initiation Protocol, which is used for signaling in modern-day telephony systems. And it's been documented as becoming everything to everyone, and that different developers can make different decisions, all within specification, and encounter problems in the wild, even after significant testing in their labs. And with so many protocols being developed by so many vendors, this problem isn't going away. So traditionally, this has been handled through bake-off events. And this is where multiple vendors get together and test their products against each other. Now, let's look at how this is done with an example. And since we're talking about SIP, we actually analyzed two SIP implementations, ExoSIP and PJSIP, and I'm going to use them for this example. So you start by defining a test case scenario, and let's say that ExoSIP will be the client, PJSIP will be the server, we'll just connect them directly to each other, and we'll decide that we want to place a phone call, so an invite message. And that basically, for whatever reason, yes. The animation seems to be out of sync between these two. Now, this part is easy. Where basically everything I've said so far is easily enumerable. There's only so many interactions that we care about. The hard part is what comes next, which is defining what inputs you put on the sender, what SIP URI you want to place the phone call to. And we basically rely on developer feedback, on intuition, to find these. There it is. So let's look at a concrete example that we actually found with our tool. And what we found is that if you tell ExoSIP to place a phone call to a URI with an empty username, say, at usc.edu, PJSIP considers the message syntactically invalid, completely drops the message, doesn't respond with an error message, and forces ExoSIP to go into an infinite retry loop. Clearly something went wrong here. And yet, if you go to the specification, it is not at all clear if there's anything wrong with this. You could think of this as a perfectly valid way for a general institutional contact. And yet, it's not clear from the specification if this should be allowed. And the point I'm trying to make here is that this is a very hard to come across test case. I don't think a developer could reasonably come up with this just off the top of their head. And ultimately, the point here is that manual testing is very human intensive. You have to get a lot of people together. It's very expensive. And at the end of the day, it's not even very comprehensive. Wouldn't it be nice if we could find a way to automate searching for inputs that automatically generate these interoperability issues? And that's what we propose to do with our tool, Protocol Interoperability Checker, or PIC for short. So PIC needs a bit of a slightly more formal definition of interoperability so that it knows what it has to do. Let me walk you through that with a quick example. Consider the sender and a receiver. On the sender side, we initiate the interaction with an API call, and the sender validates its inputs. Everything is valid. It generates a message as a consequence of that and sends it to the receiver under the assumption that the message is valid. The problem is that the receiver disagrees with the sender, considers the message invalid, and ignores it or drops it. We can also think of a more extended case with multiple messages. So we could also consider that the response is the one that is considered invalid. Now let's generalize this a little bit. Consider a message space that has every possible message in existence. As a subset of that space, you could consider every possible message that the sender can generate. And Analogously, you can consider every message that the receiver rejects. What we care about is the intersection of these two. That's where interoperability issues are. If this set is empty, the two implementations are interoperable, and any messages here are counterexamples to that. So now that we have a clear definition of what we're interested in, let me outline our contributions. So we've created a tool, PIC, that significantly automates finding these non-interoperabilities. And we do this by using program analysis techniques to automatically map out those message spaces and find properties, the messages we care about. We further devise techniques to scale PIC to real-world protocol code. And we do this by leveraging the main knowledge about how protocol code typically works to guide and prune the very large exploration space into something a little bit more manageable. Finally, we have applied our technique to SIP and SPDI protocol implementations and found about 20 issues, which we reported back to developers, and many have been acknowledged and fixed in the meantime. So let me describe how PIC works at a very high level. The first three stages here are the static analysis portion, and these are the stages that map out those message spaces, and this is also where we apply those scaling techniques I was telling you about. I will describe these stages in more detail in the following slides. The result, the output of these stages is subsequently passed through a less important post-processing stage, which I will only describe in lesser detail afterwards. So before I get into all the nitty-gritty, let me walk you through a running example that I'll be using throughout the rest of the presentation. This is NetCalc, a networked calculator. And you can think of this as a simple form of RPC, where the client is asking the server to perform an arithmetic operation. I want to point out that there is an interoperability issue in here that we put here on purpose, in that the client recognizes the subtraction operation as valid and will send it out to the server, but the server does not have the necessary code to handle that operation and would subsequently throw an exception by which we would recognize the resulting message as invalid. So to map out the message spaces, we use a technique called symbolic execution. Let me walk you through this briefly. So symbolic execution interprets the code with a special interpreter that, instead of assigning inputs and variables a concrete value, assigns them a symbol. So if we look at this in this case, the operand is assigned a symbol sigma 1. And it keeps a symbolic store that tracks the value of these symbols as they are processed through the code. So as we run through the code, you can see that we're populating each variable with these symbols. When we hit a branch statement, an if in this case, that is predicated on one of those symbols, we must fork execution into two independent paths. And we add a path condition to each one with the conditions, the constraints that are necessary that must be satisfied for that path to be executed. And here we have the two different paths for the plus branch and one for where it's not plus, which would ultimately then be explored into the remaining rest of the code. Now, the system will not just pick one of these paths and continue executing it. Let's take the first one. Now, as it keeps on running, eventually it hits a point in the code where it sends a message. At this point, we can extract the symbolic value of the message. And as you can see here, when the operation is addition, the message is a zero, with then the two arguments concatenated after the fact. The system would, of course, now explore the remaining paths, but I won't walk you through that part. Now, PIC uses this technique and applies it to both sender and receiver. On the sender side, there are three resulting paths, addition, subtraction, and one for the error case where even the sender considers the message, the input invalid. That case does not generate a message, so we just drop it. On the receiver side, there are two paths, one for handling messages that request an addition, and one for handling messages that it doesn't recognize. In this case, only the error branch is the one that is considered invalid, so we only keep that one. So now that we've mapped out the message spacing directly, how do we combine the paths, the code paths from the sender and the receiver together to get concrete cases of non-interoperability? Well, we start by doing a full path pair combination for all paths from sender and receiver. And the result in this case is just two path pairs. for when you have addition and subtraction on the client, and both trying to be handled by the branch on the receiver that for errors. Now, for each path pair, we combine the constraints from both sender and receiver. And let me walk you through this a little carefully. So we have the constraints on the receiver for a message that is considered invalid. We and in the value of a message, and we and in the constraints on the sender that are necessary to generate that message. If you think about it, these are the constraints for a non-interoperability. And we can throw this at an SMT solver. Now, the SMT solver can have one of two results. Either the constraints are unsatisfiable, which is what happens on the top branch up here, and we just ignore those, or it's satisfiable and it will give us a concrete variable assignment that will execute that particular case. And this here is telling us that if you use the subtraction operation, which you will remember the sender considered valid but the receiver did not, you have a non-interoperability. It also will come up with, in this case the arguments are arbitrary, but it will come up with two specific values for it. Now already we have a potential scaling issue here. I said that there was a full path combination here. This can be absolutely huge. And frequently we have tens, if not hundreds of thousands of paths on each side. In our early implementations, we had hundreds, we had tens of millions of path pairs to sieve through. And only very few of them are actually satisfiable. So ultimately, this sort of independent analysis of both sender and receiver does not scale to even moderately complex protocol code. So to understand that problem, let's look what it looks like in back in that message space. So as the sender is producing paths on its side, paths that generate messages, and as the receiver on its side is looking for messages code paths that handle messages it doesn't understand, we're essentially hoping that eventually they will intersect. And when they intersect, that's when we find something. But these search spaces are absolutely huge. The likelihood of these two intersecting by chance is very low and can take a very long time. So wouldn't it be nice if we could somehow let the sender do its part and then scope the receiver to only search within the messages that we know the sender can generate? And that's what we propose to do with a technique that we call joint symbolic execution. So in joint symbolic execution, the sender side is just the same. It's just producing paths that generate messages. But on the receiver side, when we receive a message, we start by forking the execution of the code for each path that we get from the sender. And let's see what it does here. So on each one of those forks, we take the corresponding path from the sender and we and in its path constraints and the value of the message. As a result, the system will at that point only execute the branches that correspond to that branch. From the sender, to that message from the sender. So if you look here, the plus branch from the sender will only execute the branch that handles the addition operation on the receiver. Ultimately, this message is considered valid, so we don't care about it. But the subtraction operation, in turn, will be handled by the exception code. And as our system will recognize this as invalid, the constraints for this path will automatically be seen as a non-interoperability. And so ultimately, by using this technique, we can scale our analysis to much larger implementations. So there were other scaling challenges we had to address. Symbolic execution is inherently incomplete. The search space is absolutely huge, and there is no time to analyze all of it. Basically because symbolic execution is trying to find all paths, or at least try to increase coverage in some sense. But the problem is that we only care about a select few of those paths that are related to interoperability and messages. To address this, we extend prior art, in particular about directed symbolic execution. Now, there are more details about this in the paper, but basically we've devised a new form of exploration called dispersive exploration, which is needed on the receiver side. And then we also devised a technique that we call return normalization that smooths out a particular pattern in code that is very common in protocols and that is generates local minima. So now that I've explained this in more detail, let me put it back into context. I've just explained the first three stages, which we collectively call joint symbolic execution. The result of this are concrete test cases, which we then feed through a validation stage. And this is used to rule out any false positives due to simplifications in the symbolic model or aliasing. Finally, we pass this through a clustering stage just to make the results more easy to understand to the developer when we report them back. So we've evaluated our tool with SIP and Speedy in protocol implementations. For Speedy, we analyzed the SpeedyLay library and Nginx. SpeedyLay is a small C library, but Nginx is a very widely deployed and very well-known web server. We also analyzed two different versions of each of these so that we could see how the code evolved over time. For SIP, we analyzed two very mature implementations, ExoSIP and PJSIP. And the takeaway from here is that these libraries grow up to about 105,000 lines of code, so this is not exactly toy code that we're analyzing. And even though the libraries are big, we only had to do a few, the developer effort only was involved was only a few tens of lines of code for annotations. To summarize our results, we found a total of 13 issues for Speedy and 9 issues for SIP. We further categorized these results as liberal sender or conservative receiver, depending on who was interpreting the standard more correctly. Some cases were just simply bugs and off by one error, for example. There were cases where there were optional features, where the spec specifically allowed something to be implemented or not, but it still caused a problem. And there were also situations where there were unsupported versions, where the client was trying to use a version of the protocol the receiver was not expecting. And for SIP, we only had cases for liberal sender and optional features. So there are quite a few more results in the paper, but I'll only highlight some of the more interesting ones here. So this is already the example I brought up earlier, where ExoSIP considers the empty username valid, but PJSIP does not. What's interesting here is that the standard is ambiguous about it. It basically says that there is a username followed by the at symbol and so on. It never says whether that username can be an empty string or not. Another interesting example is the problem with ExoSIP is that it does not validate its inputs very carefully. It basically lets anything through and get into the message, and it can ultimately mangle the message. Whereas PJSIP is very conservative and thoroughly checks all of its inputs. What happens here is that in this particular message, ExoSIP allowed a carriage return line feed character in, which completely destroys the message, and PJSIP rightfully rejects the message. What's interesting about this is that we fixed this bug, prevented ExoSIP from doing this, and then reran the analysis. And this is what we got. Now ExoSIP only allows valid tokens to get into that field. At this point, PJSIP no longer throws away that message. It goes from what we call a liberal sender problem, and now it's an optional feature problem, as PJSIP considers the message to be syntactically valid, but it says that it responds with a message saying, I don't know how to implement that feature you're requesting. And what this is telling us is that we can create a new life cycle of fixing bugs, reanalyzing, and finding deeper issues that were hidden behind them. Another interesting issue, this time in Speedy, is when you're placing a request that includes an escaped null character in the path, Nginx rejects it at a very low level. Now, you could argue that this isn't a very interesting issue. Who would care about typing a %00 anywhere in their URL bar? And maybe for the browsing user case, it's not that important. But ultimately, these systems are used to develop applications on top of them. And if you're, for example, creating a RESTful API, an application on top of Nginx, you might need to encode small objects that are ultimately binary into a URL. And all of a sudden, if there is a null character in there, you would have this issue. And the application wouldn't be able to address it. Nginx is rejecting this message at a very low level. The application never sees the result. And with that, I conclude my talk. To recap, we created a tool, PIC, which significantly automates finding non-interoperabilities in real-world protocol code. To do this, we've had to create several scaling techniques, in particular, joint symbolic execution, dispersive exploration, return normalization. We applied our technique to real-world code and found actual issues that we reported back to the developers. Many of these issues were ultimately fixed, acknowledged and fixed by the developers. For future work, we are taking our lessons we learned from joint symbolic execution, and we are creating more general analyses derived from the same technique. In particular, we're considering more abstract forms of interoperability and also protocol equivalence. I had a poster yesterday talking about this work, with live demos. If anyone here missed it, you can find me after the talk and I can show it to you again. Thank you very much.
Jun Kim from Tritech. Really great work. I had just one question. So your like joint symbolic execution, all these. Does your work work with multiple like protocols written in different languages, or is it only for like one language, like programming language? I mean.
Ultimately, we analyze LLVM bit code, so we can with assist. The ideas here can be implemented in any symbolic execution engine, but the implementation that we're using, because it uses LLVM, it can analyze any language for which there is a front end in LLVM. Typically, C and C++ are the more commonly used ones, but I've heard of other front ends for it as well.
I see. Okay.
Well, let's thank Luis.
Thank you very much.